Have you ever wondered why we have political party conventions? Where did this system and this trend come from? And does it matter anymore? Is it anything more than a PR opportunity? Are any decisions of substance actually made at these events? In this episode, Jeff talks with Dr. Eric Sands of Berry College, answering these questions, providing analysis of the current state of party conventions in 2024, and offering some insightful forecasts for what might be to come. If you want to jump right to the content of this episode, go ahead and fast forward to the 2 minute and 30 second mark on either the YouTube or this podcast. And as always, make sure to like and subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes of The American Idea.
Hi, I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center. And this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is in the news. Boy, is it in the news immediately right now. Political party conventions. Their history, their importance for America, not only historically, but perhaps even for today. And I am joined for that conversation by, my old friend. an old friend of the Ashbrook Center and of our programs for teachers around the country, Professor Eric Sands, who teaches political science at Berry College, teaches classes there, and also a course in our master's program and our TAH seminars in American politics, in the U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court, and political parties. He's the author of a great book on the mystery of Lincolnism. How come there was Abraham Lincoln, but no Lincoln political philosophy that carried on after Lincoln? Eric, thanks for taking the time to join us again on The American Idea.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
The political party and the political party convention. When did conventions start? Did we have them right from the beginning in 1788?
No, not at all. I'd say the first thing we have to take account of is that the founders didn't intend for there to be political parties. And even that is probably putting it a little too mildly. The founders really detested political parties. And they very intentionally structured the constitutional system in a way that wouldn't be reliant on political parties. So what they did as political scientists is ask the question, what do parties do in politics? And the primary function that they observed parties performing was nominating candidates for office. So not really about the election so much as where do the candidates come from? Who recruits the candidates? Who gives them training on how to stump speak and how to raise money and supporting them in other ways? And so when they constructed the Constitution, they made sure or tried to make sure that the major branches were going to be free of the party's influence in the nominating process. So we see that in the Supreme Court. Nominated by presidents, not by political parties. We see that in the presidency, nominated through the Electoral College and selected in the Electoral College. Congress is slightly more messy, but you know they basically felt that at the senatorial level, political parties were not going to play a major role in the state legislatures choosing their senators. The one institution where parties probably were going to show up a bit was going to be in the House of Representatives. But the founders really thought that was going to be localized, that wasn't going to be widespread. And that's, again, another argument in favor of the extended republic. You're going to create so many political parties, none of them are going to be able to come to an ascendancy.
Well, that's pretty amazing when you think about it, because today in 2024, if people think about politics in America, they immediately think political parties, Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. Parties have become such a dominant way of thinking about politics. It's kind of amazing that that's not how the American founders seemed to think about it, at least when they were setting up the Constitution.
Yeah, for us today, politics is unthinkable without political parties. And, you know, the founders included some pretty smart guys who really had their finger on the pulse of political science. And yet they completely missed the boat on political parties. This was one gigantic mistake they made, was that, you know, we create this political system, we implement it in 1789, and by 1793, we've got a somewhat vibrant two-party system.
That's right. I mean, just thinking about if the founders, meaning people who, you know, Declaration of Constitution, it's amazing by the 1790s, we have the Federalists and we have the Democratic Republicans, and they seem to be acting kind of like political parties. So did we start getting political party conventions then?
Political party conventions actually came on later. The Congressional Caucus was used as the nominating mechanism for candidates for office through most of the 1810s and 1820s. You know, the party caucuses would meet and they would collectively decide on who the party's nominee was going to be for the presidency in the next election cycle. That they would then quote unquote run, not in the way that we do today running for office, but you know, they'd submit their names to the people into the Electoral College for consideration, and we'd eventually get a winner. That started wearing on the electorate when the Federalists began to phase out, and the Democratic Republicans were the only party left. Because what was really effectively happening was the Congressional Caucus was simply playing kingmaker. Simply meeting and deciding, you know, James Monroe is going to be the next president of the United States and nobody's going to oppose them. And so there's a lot of statewide protest to this. There's a lot of internal party protest to this, saying, of course, this is not what the founders intended. And it's really violative of the separation of powers. The president's supposed to have an independent electoral base, and he's not getting that if the House is and the Senate are the ones that are doing the selection. So it's going to be after the election of Andrew Jackson in 1828 when they begin to, with the assistance of Martin Van Buren, start organizing and building a nationwide party system. That they listen to the voters, you know, they hear people and in their complaints about this Congressional Caucus. And 1832, we get the first national party convention. I think it was in Baltimore.
So that's fascinating to me, because that means that the political party convention started as a way to make the nomination of the president actually more democratic, less elitist, and more democratic.
Yeah, which makes it doubly ironic that one of the things that's going to seriously undermine the party conventions is the perception that they aren't democratic. So it is kind of a democratic remedy for, you know, a process that was seen as too undemocratic, but itself is going to become problematic over the long run in the 19th century, and the progressives are going to come at it as being undemocratic.
So tell us about the first political party convention, starting in 1832 and through the 1800s. What's it like to be at a political party convention?
It's wild. It's overflow of passion and emotion and excitement. You get these huge convention halls where you'd have thousands of people that would show up. Various individuals are getting a chance to speak at the podium, but you remember going into them, you don't know who the presidential candidate is going to be. It's not like today where we've known since May who the nominees are going to be. You genuinely have no clue. And for the most part, the nomination is up for grabs. So you've got the candidates and their campaign organizations working behind the scenes to secure blocks of states, blocks of voters, And, you know, we'll be frank, there's a lot of dirty dealing going on. You scratch probably my back.
Probably some money and some whiskey.
Probably some money and some whiskey at the very least is going to be going on. But yeah, I mean, it's an almost carnival atmosphere. It's a good time. People, you know, enjoy being there. And it's highly participatory. You know, this isn't one of those things where all of the delegates to the convention are professional party men. You know, depending on who is selected to represent the state in the state nominating conventions, you could have Joe Farmer who is showing up and participating in the process.
Well, let me, if I understand this right, then. So to take a state, so to Tennessee, for example, in you know, 1856, if they have a convention, there's a Democratic convention that year. What happens is folks in Tennessee who are, say, members of the Democratic Party would show up to the state nominating convention. And then the state convention would select delegates, select them to go to wherever the National Party convention was to then listen to the speeches and decide who the Democrats' nominee was going to be.
Yeah. If you were selected as a state delegate to the convention, there was an understanding that you needed to take very seriously your voters' preferences. So I don't want to create the impression that you were completely free to vote for whomever you want. But the delegation as a whole, you know, is probably going to make decisions about what it's going to do collectively with its ballots. And sometimes, you know, you got to give a little to get a little, and you got to leverage the votes that you have, especially for small states, and get what you can out of it. So it's not uncommon for some of these conventions to go on 4 or 5 days.
You mean taking that long to finally select a nominee?
Absolutely. You Democrats in particular are going to have a really rough time because the southern states in their party were very upset that they were losing influence in the electoral process. And so they got the Democrats as a way of appeasing them to adopt a two-thirds rule. So you had to get two-thirds of the delegate votes instead of just a simple majority. That's not easy in any context. That's not easy, but that's now going to be a requirement every 4 years. So you will see some elections where the Democrats go to over 300 ballots.
Wow.
Over 300 ballots will be cast in some cases before they get a candidate. Now, sometimes that's not the case. I mean, when Andrew Jackson runs for re-election, everybody basically knows he's getting he's going to be renominated. So that's not a big thing. But, you know, in elections that feature people like Buchanan or Pierce, who are hardly inspiring figures, you know, it's probably going to take a lot longer.
So tell us, you know, if you're thinking about the 19th century, what is one or some of the most consequential political conventions that take place?
Well, certainly 1860 is the one that stands out the most. Abraham Lincoln has only recently emerged on the scene as a national party figure. Most people knew Seward and presumed that he was going to be the Republican nominee in 1860.
This is William Seward, who ends up in Lincoln's cabinet.
Yes, exactly him. Some things that Seward said in the past ends up coming up in 1860 and makes him look much more of an abolitionist than I think he actually was. And the party, I think, just realizes we can't afford to put an abolitionist on the ticket. That is a recipe for civil war. And so Lincoln looks like the more moderate or conservative alternative, and one that, you know, could hopefully save the Union if it was put together. But obviously, given everything Lincoln does, given everything Lincoln says, you know, over the next 4 years, in terms of consequence, that's a huge election, maybe even the most important party convention ever.
Tell us a little bit about how Lincoln actually ends up winning. If you said people thought it was going to be William Seward, and Lincoln is not nearly as well known nationally among Republicans, how does a guy like Lincoln win? Is it making deals? Is it dirty tricks? Is it just coming and giving speeches? How does Lincoln end up prevailing?
Well, some of it is him continually giving speeches. The Lincoln-Douglas debates help enormously, not just because of the force of Lincoln's arguments in those debates, but people were able to start looking at him as someone that could stand up as a national party figure. This is the guy who took on the most prominent individual in American politics at that time. And all right, it's disputable whether he won the debates or not. I mean, that's a hard thing to lay down, but he certainly did hold his own. And nearly won that senatorial election in Illinois. Douglas's campaign had to resort to some kind of dirty tactics in order to secure his nomination. So this helps get Lincoln on the map, and everything he says from that point forward is going to be printed and copied and recopied all around the country. So he's riding a wave of popularity, and he's riding a wave of credibility when he enters into the Republican convention. And then, yes, while he's there, people forget this about Lincoln all the time. He was a consummate politician. He knew how to play the game. You know, he wasn't this towering moralist who just stood up and gave speeches that let us know who we are as a people. Not that I'm underplaying that. That is very significant about Lincoln. But he also knew how to scratch other people's backs. You know, he knew how to get down in the mud. He knew how to leverage. He knew how to log roll and all of those other kinds of things. And he and his organization were very effective at doing that at the Republican convention.
So at that time, would Lincoln have actually come personally? I think the convention was in Chicago that year.
Yeah.
Would he have personally gone to Chicago, or did the candidates then not personally engage in that kind of politicking at the convention?
So what would happen is the candidates would formally accept the nomination, and they would endorse the platform. Some candidates did that in person. Some candidates just let it be known that they endorsed the platform and accepted the nomination. But from that point forward, and my students are always so incredulous about this, the president disappears on the campaign trail. He runs what's known as a front porch campaign. He stays at home. And the party does all of the campaigning on his behalf.
That's hard for us to imagine today.
It's impossible for us to imagine. But
what was the idea behind that?
The parties in particular favored this because the presidency is the most visible elected office for the political party. What is the one thing you don't want a president doing on the campaign trail? You don't want him saying something divisive and something that's going to cost the party votes. Because there's more at stake in an election than just the presidency. You know, you got senatorial votes, House votes, governorships, state legislative seats, local elections. You know, the party's trying to do well along all these things. And you get a president who stands up and says the wrong thing. You know, all of a sudden, all down the ticket, you start getting big losses. Andrew Johnson figured this out when he was president. Saying that instead of hanging traitors like Robert E. Lee and Alexander Stevens, we should be hanging the real traitors like Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens. That got a reaction.
Yeah, wow.
and in fact, that becomes the 10th article of impeachment against Johnson, was basically using intemperate language against a sitting member of Congress. Yeah, the parties don't want to risk that. You know, they just don't want to risk that. So the party runs your campaign on your behalf. That doesn't mean you have no input into what's being said. I mean, obviously, there's going to be some coordination going on, but it's the party that's going to do the messaging.
So how long does this system of nominating the president by this political convention where people show up, they don't even quite know who it's going to be. There might be a favorite, but maybe a dark horse like Lincoln emerges and actually wins. That's starting, as you say, around 1832 or in the 1830s, and then it continues on. How long does that style of really important convention, where the parties run the convention selects the nominee, then the parties run the nominee's campaign for him for president, how long does that last?
If I have to pick a date for that, I'd say 1968. Would be the date I chose.
But, wow, so 130 years?
Yeah. The beginning of the end of that, though, happens during the Progressive era. When the progressives start to critique these conventions as being, you know, corrupt bargains among party elite to force certain candidates of their choosing into office. This is the image that we get of the smoke-filled room with the party bosses all sipping cognac and having good cigars and talking amongst themselves about who the best candidate is going to be and who they should direct their delegates to vote for. To the progressives, that was not representative of a democratic process. You know, the people don't have a real choice anymore. They're just following the direction of the elites. Well, the progressives then come up with some ideas about how to reform this system to make it difficult. And
when do we start seeing some of those progressive ideas and progressive reforms?
1890s is when the progressives really start taking their ideas to the state level. My good state of Georgia is actually the first to implement primaries as a system for nominating candidates to office. This, of course, means that the voters vote for nominees for office as opposed to the parties appointing nominees for office. But the movement spreads from there. And by the time we get into the 1910s, we've got maybe 17, 18 states that are selecting with primaries. So it's become, you know, it's become a real thing at that point. Not enough to ultimately shape the outcome of the nomination, because there's far more states than 17 that are still using the caucus or convention system. But it is out there at least. And the credibility of it is really first challenged in 1912 during that disputed election between Taft and Wilson and T.R. T.R. wins the primaries. And so he comes to the convention.
And Teddy Roosevelt's running as a Republican, right?
Yeah, he's running as a Republican. He says, I should be the nominee. And they engage in various shenanigans and stuff. But, you know, really the problem was T.R. didn't have a majority of the nominations votes at that time. So
I'm understanding it. 1912, TR wins the primaries, but then it gets to the Republican National Convention, and the Republicans select Taft instead of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep, and again, it's simply because there aren't enough primaries at that time to secure the nomination through popular vote. You had to win the nomination at the party convention, and party insiders at that time were much more amenable to Taft than they were to TR. TR had become, in the views of many, very radicalized and was starting to take on policy positions and, you know, ideologies that didn't really seem to fit the Republican Party anymore, or at least what they were comfortable with. And so, as we all know, Teddy Roosevelt says, fine, then I'll form my own political party and I'll beat you that way. And that didn't work, but nonetheless.
So we start to see these reforms like primary elections, but the convention, as you say, still has a lot of importance. But you absolutely said up until 1968. What happens in 1968 that changes things?
The Democrats have a disastrous convention in 68. They had a president who was an incumbent, Lyndon Johnson. And the conventional wisdom of the day, and by the way, this is highly relevant to the situation with Joe Biden. The conventional wisdom of the day was that a party could not challenge a sitting president for renomination. It simply wasn't done. Now, that's not a constitutional mandate. there's nothing there that says that can't be done, but it's just precedent. You don't challenge a sitting president. The party doesn't do that, except for this one wild card figure, Eugene McCarthy, who, because of anti-war reasons, sides with the student movements against the war. And he does end up challenging Johnson for the nomination, ends up doing remarkably well against him in the New Hampshire primary. I think he only lost it by about 12 points, something like that, which shouldn't have ever happened, given all of the advantages that Johnson had at the time. Well, Johnson gets the message, and he realizes he doesn't have the popular support he needs to win the presidency, and he steps down. He remains in the presidency, but he steps down and says, okay, let's open it up to another candidate. And that's when Bobby Kennedy enters the race. The significant candidate, though, was not the ones in the primary races. It was, of course, Hubert Humphrey. And Humphrey chose not to run in any of the primaries, just ignored them entirely and said, I'm going to win the nomination at the convention because all I need to do is to impress the party insiders that I'm the best candidate for the job and I'll win it. I think his strategy would have failed had Kennedy lived. I think if Kennedy had gone in to the convention with the momentum that he had from the primaries, he would have had the nomination at that point. But he's assassinated, and so all of those primary votes went to McCarthy. And so for him, it's pretty simple. I've already got the support of however many states it was at that time. I'm the people's candidate. I'm the one that people want as the nominee for the Democratic nomination. And instead, the party insiders just shoved him aside. I think the story goes they didn't even allow him to speak at the 68 convention. And they immediately end up nominating Hubert Humphrey. And there's a huge mass of student protesters in Chicago, sort of watching the convention. When it happens, they start to riot, and police officers are seen on television beating the students, and their response is the whole world is what. So it's a massive debacle. And the immediate consequence is two straight landslide election victories for the Republicans with Richard Nixon. So the Democrats know they've got to change something. And what they do is put together a commission, famously called the McGovern-Fraser Commission, that makes a whole bunch of recommendations of changes in the nominating process. But the most important thing it recommends is that all states adopt primaries as the mechanism for nominating their candidates to office. And so over the next 40 years, 50 years, almost all the states are going to adopt primaries. I always forget exact how many still have used the convention method. It's like three or four, but the decision about who the nominee is going to be is always done now well ahead of time.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Okay, so we get, since 1968, then as you say, the primaries become the way, not the convention.
Right.
Selecting who the nominee is going to be. But we still do have political conventions. They still meet. They met in, Republicans met in Milwaukee, right? Democrats meeting in Chicago. What role, now that primaries have become the dominant way of picking the presidential nominee, what role, if any, do conventions have today?
Well, that's a great question. And one that at least those of us in political science circles don't really have a great answer to. In fact, some of my more cynical colleagues will tell you that conventions don't serve any purpose whatsoever. They're just big pep rallies, highly scripted, you know, nothing spontaneous, but they're just basically pep rallies. To those voters who perhaps don't know who the nominee is, it gives them a chance to get introduced to them, to see them, to hear them, get a sense of what their policy positions are. But aside from that, I mean, there still are oftentimes some pretty virulent platform fights. This was most true in the 1980s with the Democratic Party, but it still goes on. So one area of that, for example, would be pro-Israeli and anti-Israeli factions of the Democratic Party, you know, wanting control over how they structure the language about Israel.
And those things, as you're saying, or I'm thinking of the dispute at this year's Republican convention on the abortion issue.
Absolutely.
So the platform of the political party, which is its official statement of here's our positions on the various policies of the United States, and presumably it's connected to what their candidate supports, and the candidate embraces the platform and vice versa. The conventions still, though, have arguments and disputes about what the party's platform is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They try to paper over those differences as much as possible, but some toes are going to get stepped on. Some people's interests are not going to be fully represented or as fully represented as they want them to be. So that's always a difficulty in managing the platform. But yeah, the other problem is, though, who reads these platforms?
I don't know if they're published online or in newspapers.
Right.
Or...
They used to be published in newspapers back when they were 5 pages long. But now that they're hundreds of pages long, because we have so many special interest groups that show up at the conventions demanding, you know, that their niche issue is the one that, you know, has to be represented in the platform. Usually you can find them online. But if you've got a spare 3-4 hours to read through all the issues that they're going to take up, and it's not even all that clear that the nominees take them all that seriously. Certainly Trump in 2016 and 2020, you know, when the Republicans, you know, introduced the platform and stuff, he was kind of like, yeah, whatever. If I can accomplish some of those things, I will, but you know, I'm not going to be bothered with most of it. I don't think that's anything unique to Trump. This is one of the consequences of moving to this primary system, is that campaigns are candidate centered. Right? They're not party centered. And so candidates run under a party label. But the content of that campaign is very much their own.
So in many ways, we've really moved from a party-based candidate to a candidate-based party. It's really based about the candidates now. But I know some of our listeners are thinking, okay, Eric, that might be true in general, but this year had the potential to be different because for the Democrats, because Joe Biden dropped out. And the possibility, people were talking about what's called an open convention. What does that mean? And could that have happened this year for the Democrats?
Yes, it could have happened. It would only have worked if Biden had dropped out. It would have been a much messier process if Biden had not dropped out and the party tried to replace him anyway. That would have been really bad for the Democratic Party, and probably would have raised a host of legal issues that the court would have to resolve about what can happen and what can't happen in the nomination process. If it was a truly open convention, then, of course, all the delegates that have been selected by the states show up not having a mandate about who they choose. You know, they have unlimited choice in front of them.
So it could have been that they had shown, if Kamala Harris had not been selected, I guess, as she was, I think, by the delegates sort of agreed to support her at the convention.
Yeah.
Before they got to the convention, there could have been an old fashioned political convention where the delegates showed up, not knowing it could have been Harris, it could have been somebody else. And they could have had an actual argument on the floor and votes on the floor to select the nominee.
Yeah, that's exactly what could have happened. Certainly all of the major contenders could have been invited to give speeches on their own behalf. To talk about what qualities they bring to office and why they're most competent to do the job. That would have been kind of fascinating to watch.
Why didn't it happen?
Because there's also a very high chance of chaos. Parties like managed conventions. it demonstrates unity and capability in the party. You know, if you can't organize your own political party, how do you expect to organize the electorate? Right? How can you govern effectively if you can't even get your own people in line? So, well, I think there was every reason things could have gone very well for the Democrats at their convention. Things could have also turned into a disaster because, again, a lot of those delegates that are coming to office or coming to the party conventions don't have a lot of political experience. Right? The kind of old guard or the super delegates that go to the convention, the real party professionals, you know, that's one of the reasons they're there at the convention, is to help guide the rookies in what they're doing. And so I think those super delegates would have probably played a major role at the party convention had it gone that way. But I think another reason is the Democrats just didn't want to wait until September to have a nominee in the ring against Trump. I mean, that gives him a month and a half to be hammering the Democratic Party and any Democratic nominee. And that gives you what? About a month and a half to respond and get yourself ready for the general election. That's not a lot of time.
I've heard some Republicans who are critical of Donald Trump and some Democrats who are critical of Kamala Harris say, we need to bring back the party convention because the primaries are producing candidates that a lot of people in the party don't actually want as our nominee. But they're winning the primaries. And therefore, we need to restrain the primaries and go back to party conventions that are really run by people who know who the best candidates should actually be. You hear a few people talking like that in the contemporary climate. Is there any chance that something like that could happen?
Well, as a normative question, you know, should we do something like that? I'm actually very supportive of that. I think the parties would do an infinitely better job choosing candidates than the primaries do. The primaries are producing very ideologically charged and very ideologically extreme candidates, ones that only appeal to, you know, a moderate percentage of the party, and then are able to knock off a few extra votes in the party from people who are saying, well, well, you know, the problem is the other guys aren't putting up somebody that I think is all that much better. So I may as well stick with my guy. And then are leaving independents in a real lurch, you know, which way they want to go. Could parties do better than this? Yeah, I think they could. I think if you put the hands in the party professionals, it would produce more moderate candidates, and candidates that are willing to work with the opposition, candidates that are willing to compromise, and, you know, arguably better qualified candidates as well. Is it likely to happen, though? There aren't a lot of examples in American history where an institution or an election process has been democratized and we've gone back on it later.
You know, so once this is just sort of the inevitable progress of democracy. Once the vote, once the nomination has been democratized, once we have primaries, and especially once the primaries are open to everybody voting in them, it can't go back.
Yeah, I think the analogy you could make to this is the direct election of senators. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that moving the senatorial elections to the direct will of the people has not really worked in favor of producing highly qualified senators. Instead, it seems to produce more demagogues than it does people who are coming into the process looking to advance a notion of the common good. But can we really imagine getting a constitutional amendment passed today saying we're going back to the state legislatures, selecting senators? I have trouble imagining that. I do have trouble imagining that. So if it were to happen, it would happen at the state level, and it would require a really well-funded and well-organized grassroots campaign to push state legislatures into changing the mechanism system from primaries back to conventions.
If that's true, then if I think, and I think it's obviously controversial for you to say it should happen, but it's not going to happen. If that's true, then what's the future? It's not going to happen. Then what's the future of the political convention?
Honestly, as much as it hurts me to say, because I love conventions, they're one of my favorite things to study in political parties, I think they're going to fade into obscurity. I think networks are going to stop devoting primetime coverage to them, which is really the biggest benefit that the party gets out of the conventions is, you know, people tuning into CNN and Fox News and ABC and, you know, all those, and, you know, representing that party's take on politics and their candidates for free. You know, they don't have to pay for that. And so that's a lot of firsthand campaigning that they can accomplish. But when I think back to when I was a kid, which is starting to be a long time ago, but when I think back to it, when the party conventions were being held, there was almost constant attention on what was going on. I mean, I remember you'd turn on the television on NBC in the morning and convention coverage started at 9 a.m. and went on until 11 o'clock at night. And oftentimes it was uninterrupted. Yeah, or they'd make a commercial interruption in between speeches or while they were setting something up or something like that. Now the networks have basically gone down to we're only willing to devote time in that prime time, 8 to 11 slot. And those hours, the networks are losing revenue. They're losing a significant amount of revenue. So I think it's the networks themselves that are going to ask the question, what are we gaining from this? You know, what? If you're going to make me an argument for how this is good for democracy, what is that good? You know, how is it improving democracy? And if you don't have a great answer to that question, well, maybe we're not feeling so generous about our time.
So is it conceivable then that the political convention actually, the party convention actually ends up not even meeting in person? It just becomes online?
I think that's one way it could be done. So many things going virtual these days. And that's possibly one of the ways it could meet. Obviously, it wouldn't surprise me that the people that are on the platform committees, I doubt in this day and age that they're all sitting in a hotel room together, you know, hashing out the different planks and all of those kinds of things. I'm sure they're probably in individual rooms, and some may not even be in the city, and they're making their contributions via electronic means. So that wouldn't be changing things all that much from what's probably already going on.
So the Republic starts without party conventions, and you're suggesting that we may see a return to the end of the party convention in many ways.
It's possible. It's possible. Unless somebody can come forward and make a really solid and comprehensible case for what purpose the convention serves. You know, again, other than just serving as a pep rally for the political party. The only thing that has really been exciting or dramatic about the conventions is the president's announcement of his vice presidential candidate. Now, those are the few moments at the conventions where everyone's like, oh, you know, we've got this new person to pay attention to. But you saw in this go around, both of the candidates have already announced their vice presidential candidates prior to the convention. So that takes that mystery out of it. And so once again, now you're saying even more, what exactly is the purpose of this then?
Well, that's fascinating. What an interesting, insightful, historical look at the party convention with your own opinions and prognostications. I appreciate you being with us, taking the time to join us. Maybe if those who love party conventions among our listeners, if Eric is right, well, you better be tuning in now while you still can. Eric Sands, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.